Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review and to the first book review of 2017. I'm Matt Alagaya, and on the programme today we're going to be finding out what's on Anne Meadows' reading list for January. Anne Meadows is commissioning editor at Granta and Portobello Books and joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the show, Anne. Our first book today is called Homegoing. It's a story of two half-sisters, Effia and Essie, who live in separate villages in 18th century Ghana. The book unravels their opposing destinies and those of seven future generations of their families. And what sort of journey does the author Yaa Gyasi take us on here?
It's an epic journey. So this novel switches between Effia's descendants and Essie's descendants, these two half-sisters who never meet. And at the beginning of the novel, Effia, who is a daughter of an Asante chief, is given in marriage to the governor of this castle called Coast Castle, which is a slavery castle, though she doesn't know it at the time. And this British man comes to her village and whisks her away and takes her to this castle. And she lives there not quite as his wife, but as his wench, because he has a wife back home in Britain. And what she doesn't know, but we as the reader come to know, is that in the keep of the castle, in the dungeons, are hundreds of women who have been taken as slaves and who are going to be sold by the British into slavery. And one of these women is Afia's half-sister, Essie. And Essie comes from another village, and she has been sold into slavery as an act of revenge. And so then the novel switches between Afia's descendants and Essie's descendants, and we move from a plantation in the southern states of America through to Harlem, through to Pennsylvania, and also we follow Afia's descendants who remain in Ghana and for the most part are wealthy, but who have bad dreams and shame and darkness in their lives as well.
And it's an interesting structure as well. I mean, it literally is, each chapter kind of alternates telling the story of Effia's descendants and then Essie's. What do you think that structure, that device gives you?
What the structure does, and what it does so brilliantly, is it restores this narrative to people who have been denied their history. So Essie's descendants, which includes a young woman who has terrible scars on her body, who's living in a plantation working in slavery, and then her descendant, who is a free man, who's been smuggled to safety and is a free man, but whose wife is stolen from him when the slavery laws change. These people don't know where they've come from. They don't always know who their parents are, and they certainly don't know about the history of the Asante people and the Fante people on the west coast of Africa. And the novel gives us this history. It gives us this chain by showing how it's been occluded from these people's lives and people who literally are enslaved and then later who are being enslaved by systems of racial prejudice or oppression. It restores something that has been lost, and it's an incredibly powerful device. I've never come across anything quite like it, and it's very ambitious, and I mean, Yaa Gyasi deserves enormous praise, I think, for this book.
And she's a 26-year-old writer, and this is her debut novel. Tell us a little bit about her. I mean, does her own sort of personal story resemble either of these characters' stories, do you know?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I know that Yaa Gyasi is Ghanaian by birth, and that she was raised in America. And the novel ends with two characters in the present day, Marcus and Marjorie, who meet and unite these two lines. And Marjorie's story might resemble Yaa Gyasi's, but really I think she's talking about a broader African-American history and a broader African history.
And I mean, it's interesting, it comes at such a time that where, you know, arguably race in America is more volatile now than it was 10 years ago, say. Do you think there's something in that, that, you know, this is telling a story that America needs to hear now?
Absolutely. I mean, this is very much a novel of the present day. I think it has strong resonances with Black Lives Matter. It has strong resonances with the work of Ta-Nehisi Coates and Claudia Rankine. I think a different generation, perhaps, the emphasis in the book might have been more hopeful. I think in some ways we're in a very dark period for the rights of African Americans in the States, and a realization that, you know, that these legacies of oppression, particularly in police brutality and numbers of people convicted for crimes and racial bias, the awareness of that this generation has and the anger around that fuels this book.
Homegoing by Yaa Gyasi was released last year in the US, and the UK version is out now, published by Penguin. Let's move on now to a series of short stories under the title Homesick for Another World by Otessa Moshfeghi. These 14 tales explore themes of alienation, displacement, sexual neuroses and addiction. And give us a few examples of the kinds of stories that we're dealing with here and what unites them.
What unites them is definitely a very dark sense of humour and an interest in shame and disgust. This is probably a book to read when you're hungover, or it'll certainly make you feel hungover. And there are lots of stories of addiction in here. The first story, which might be my favourite, is about a school teacher. The story is called Bettering Myself, and she's a chronic alcoholic working in a convent school, and she's has sort of inappropriate friendships with her students and a much younger lover and an ex-husband who starts paying her to stop calling him. And all the while, she's speaking to us in this voice, which is sardonic and clever and knows, is very knowing about the kind of degradation that she is putting her body through and the hopelessness of it. And that's why I read Moshfeghi, I think. It's for the clarity of that voice. It's for someone looking you in the eye all the while presenting the worst of themselves. She's very real in that sense.
And most people, well, people might know Moshfeghi's name because of her novel Eileen, which was shortlisted for the Booker last year. How do these short stories compare with her novel? I mean, you mentioned that voice. Is that a voice that people will recognise from Eileen?
I think so, but Homesick for Another World also displays an incredible range. Eileen was narrated by a young woman in the 1960s. The stories here are mostly in the present day, but they're women young and old, they're men. There's one story that takes place in China. There's another story that takes place in a kind of fantastical Russian village where these two children believe that they come from an alien planet, and the only way to get back there is either to kill yourself or to work out who you have to kill to open a portal to return. So while Eileen's intensity and Eileen's honesty are certainly present in many of the narrators, there's a broader range, and she is an astonishingly good short story writer. I first read her short stories. Many of them have been in the Paris Review. She has nailed that craft.
And as you mentioned, I mean, we meet various characters along the way here, all of whom seem to be kind of seeking an alternative form of life. What sort of view of society do you think you get from reading these tales? Is there one sort of sense you get, yeah, of society from reading them, or are they all so different?
Well, she's writing about losers predominantly and misfits, people who feel themselves to be outside of society or people who really are outside of society. So in a way, I guess it's quite a narrow section, and maybe it's slightly strange that I enjoy it so much. But it's definitely within a tradition of American writing. I mean, she reminds me a lot of Nathaniel West, who was a wonderful writer from the 1940s, or more recently, Dennis Johnson, whose short stories Jesus Son took place in a similar milieu. And I think that the trick she pulls off is that even though these people are really only one slice of society, even if they're from very different backgrounds and genders and ethnicities, they come to feel like they stand in for what our society really is, which is maybe quite a bleak thing to say, but it's also kind of delightful.
What do you mean by that? That they stand in for what society is? That's a really interesting idea.
They feel like the most honest people in the world they're in, all of them, even when they're not really being honest with themselves. And I suppose their vanities and their inhibitions feel like the kind of underbelly of the lives that everyone is living.
Interesting. Homesick for Another World by Otessa Moshfeghi is out now, published by Penguin. We'll end the show with Future Sex, A New Kind of Free Love by Emily Witt. And this is Witt's own tale of being single in her 30s and going on a rather adventurous journey for love. Tell us a bit about what happens in this story.
So Future Sex is a book about the intersection of sexuality and technology and economics, how we live our lives now. And the point that the author starts from, Emily Witt, is she's 30 and she is recently single. And she had always assumed that her sort of life of sexual abandon, which is not, in fact, you know, any more extravagant than I think most people's 20s, would stop, and she would find someone she loved and she would commit to a monogamous relationship, and that would be that, you know, that the age of sexual adventure would end. And she doesn't meet anyone, and the age of sexual adventure doesn't end, even though she wants it to, even though she does want at that point. in her life to be monogamous and married and happy. And so she decides to start interrogating these ideas. You know, why do we assume that sexual freedom and an intimate and close relationship are opposite to each other? Why do we assume that porn is bad? Why do we assume that selling sex is wrong? Why do we assume that we should stay away from the darker recesses of the internet? And she takes us on a series of adventures, I suppose. She goes to San Francisco and experiences orgasmic meditation. She goes to Burning Man Festival and sleeps with strangers and takes drugs. She meets a polyamorous couple in San Francisco who are getting married. And it's a very American book in a lot of ways, but what really interested me and what really spoke to me was how honest she is about the difficulties of relationships, and maybe particularly difficulty of relationships for a generation, the millennial generation, who have been given all of these freedoms, almost infinite freedom, and yet who don't really seem to want them, who still want this very traditional archetype of a relationship, which is just two people till death do us part. Even though I think most of us realistically know that, you know, the divorce rate's at 40%, and oh gosh, when you see those studies in the Daily Mail of how many people cheat on their partners and things, it might not be realistic, and yet we are all still pushing for it. And many people, Emily Witt, at the beginning of this book, certainly are not happy with that situation.
You mentioned that Witt moves to San Francisco, which obviously the tech center of the world. I mean, there are so many dating apps that have come out of San Francisco. Does she make a reference to how technology has changed modern romance? Is this definitely a story that couldn't have been written, say, even 10 years ago, before the likes of Tinder and Bumble and all the rest of them?
In a lot of ways, yes. I think that what Witt identifies technology as having given us is a kind of plethora in which our desires are anywhere. You know, you type whatever you're thinking of into Google, be it I want to have sex with someone dressed as a giant panda, and you'll probably be able to find what you want within a matter of minutes, which is new to our generation. But the sort of freedom of relationship she's talking about, she harks back to the 1960s and, you know, the era of free love, which our parents' generation broadly rejected. So in some ways, what she says is that technology has brought us new freedoms, but the actual sex that we can be having isn't new. There's nothing futuristic about it, really. And the relationships we're having are Victorian. So there's this kind of temporal disconnect between these three different ways of living your life.
And this could be seen, I say this cautiously, but this could be seen as quite a lonely tale. What's the tone of the book? It's a sort of topic that could head down quite a depressing road, I guess, or a much more lighthearted one. Which way do we go?
It is neither depressing nor lighthearted, I would say. It reminded me of Joan Didion's writing, you know, that same clear gaze and that same sense of wanting to interrogate life and to use your own life in part as a prism for your journalism. I mean, you know, Witt ends in a good place. She says she ends with a new understanding of sexuality. She ends in a relationship which may or may not be monogamous, but is certainly committed. And I think that if you like, you know, Maggie Nelson's work, or if you like Joan Didion, or if you like Susan Sontag, you'll find a lot in here. But its pleasures are largely cerebral, I would say. It's not a particularly sexy book or a particularly funny book. It's just very, very smart and sharp.
Okay. Future Sex, A New Kind of Free Love by Emily Witt, is out now in the UK, published by Faber and Faber. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks very much to my guest, Anne Meadows. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. This show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our chat about the world of film. But for now, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.